Welcome to Brighteon.com. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon, and today's interview is with a special guest, Dr. Pierre Corey. He is the author of this must-read book called The War on Ivermectin. It's available at booksellers everywhere. We'll talk about that book. He's also the co-founder and medical director at the FLCCC Alliance that I have up here. We'll talk about that, but let's welcome him to the show. Dr. Pierre Corey, it's an honor to have you on. Thank you for joining me today.
Mike, now the honor is mine. Thanks for having me.
Well, we appreciate you spending time with us, and your book is, I think, critical reading, The War on Ivermectin. How is it that this molecule, this life-saving, Nobel Prize-winning molecule, could be so disparaged by the so-called evidence-based medical community over the last couple of years?
Yeah, well, so the book, although the book focuses on ivermectin, it really is, it's just a case example of the decades-long war on generic, off-patent, repurposed drugs. I mean, ivermectin is just the latest, and I would say the most calamitous war on repurposed drugs. But, to your question, Mike, I mean, I can't think of a compound or a molecule that was as threatening to the objectives of the forces at play in COVID. And, the easiest one to talk about is the financial ones, right? I mean, literally overnight, you had a massive market open up across the world for vaccines and then other pharmaceuticals, right? Like Paxlovid and Molnupiravir, monoclonal antibodies and Remdesivir. I mean, massive market, right? Because almost everyone on Earth was going to get COVID. And so suddenly you have the Earth as a customer, and there's little old ivermectin, time-tested, safe, ubiquitous. I mean, it's available in every country of the world. Almost everyone in the world could have access to ivermectin easily. And it would turn out to be wickedly effective against COVID. And so they had a problem on their hands. And, that's what my book is about. You know, I would say my book is, it's part biography. I kind of go through a little bit of my career, but then I really go through my COVID journey because, ivermectin is really just one chapter. I've fought a lot of frauds on this one.
Dr. Corey, it's extraordinary, though, what you're saying even right now is that some power base within the medical establishment actively sought to deprive the people of access to something that could have saved who knows how many lives, countless lives. How can we find ourselves in this situation?
Well, as I've come to learn, so I would say, Mike, before COVID, I mean, I kind of knew that Big Pharma was not to be trusted. I kind of knew that they pulled hijinks and probably manipulated some data here and there to sell their wares. I mean, I had a general sense that, they were not a ethical or moral functioning industry. But what I've come to find out is they're literally a criminal syndicate. And when you ask, how could they do this? What I've since discovered in my studies of the history of the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, they do not care. They do not care if people die. They will suppress evidence of adverse effects of their own products. They will, they'll attack competitors that might threaten their profits. And in this case, the scope and the scale of the consequences of attacking ivermectin was that most of the developed world, I mean, I would say the advanced health economies around the world, I mean, they literally removed ivermectin from hospital formularies. they frightened and threatened pharmacists to not fill the drug. And that was the other thing. It's not only the corrupt and criminal history of the pharmaceutical industry that I learned about, but it's actually the control that they've gained over the institutions of medicine. And that control is The most shocking to me is their iron-fisted control over the high-impact medical journals. Because it was really, for me, that's the foundation of how they conducted the war, is what they published in the highest-impact medical journals in the world. And those studies that were done, remember, they hired nothing but pharma-conflicted investigators for those studies. I mean, the people who ran those studies literally worked for Pfizer, okay?
Right.
Or for a competitor, ivermectin. It was just... it's almost laughable if you find this funny, which I don't, but and so you see the control over the journals, you see the control over the agencies. I mean, anyone who's gotten a leadership position from those health agencies is literally working in the service of the pharmacy. You don't get to where Fauci is unless you're a water boy for pharma, and even include the FDA committees that are approving those vaccines. And the list goes on and on, but the point I want to make, and I'll stop there, is you know, I got to see just how tight the control is. And I mean, every policy that came out, every edict that came out, you know, all the lies that came out were to serve the pharmaceutical industry and whoever's behind them.
That is sobering. And I'm glad you recognize that. And a lot of people have, including many medical professionals, but some still have not. Some are still drinking the Kool-Aid. But I remember, you know, I've advocated for nutrition, naturopathic modalities for over 20 years. And for a lot of those years, the criticism was from the, you know, the establishment was, oh, well, our medicine is evidence-based and our science is self-correcting. Those were the claims. And they said, well, if there's new evidence that shows something works, we will embrace it because we are scientists. But what you have described, and especially in your book, The War on Ivermectin, shreds that entire bogus narrative. They're not driven by evidence. They're driven by profits for Big Pharma.
I like what you said, and I appreciate your background, Mike. And I would call you one of the OGs, you know, the original gangsters in really trying to promote, you know, healthy behaviors with safe compounds and nutraceuticals. And, you know, it's interesting, Mike, because I want to say something about that. You know, I'm a system doc, and you know, I'm an allopath. I mean, I was trained in critical care and lung disease, and I mean, I basically used pharmaceuticals my whole career. And now that I've left and I started a private practice where I'm focusing on the treatment of complex chronic illnesses, you know, long COVID and vaccine injury syndromes, and I'm learning a ton about nutritional aspects to health and all sorts of therapies, which if you'd asked me about 3 years ago, I've been like, that's wacko stuff. There's no evidence for that. That's what all those alternative guys, you know, I had that kind of arrogant, dismissive attitude that's inculcated in you when you are like at the tops of science, right? Is that we have,
right.
But to your point on what you said, I will tell you the thing that just crushes me about this evidence-based medicine is that they've literally taken that over and they use that and they wield that like a club. And one of the best ways in which they do that is they use a term called insufficient evidence. So
right.
You bring forth, right? They're going to say insufficient evidence to support your assertion that Nigella sativa is helpful or whatever it is, right? But then when you look at what defines sufficient evidence, it's an absolute joke. It's a one trial. Like, for instance, right, we penned a contract and we bought billions of dollars of remdesivir based on a trial done by the company before the data was even released. It was only, remember the press conference with Fauci and Trump in the Oval Office, and we literally bought billions. And so there's sufficient evidence for when you have a pricey patented pharmaceutical, one trial will do it. But everything right. else is insufficient. They just dismiss everything as insufficient evidence.
You've really nailed something there, and I appreciate you bringing that up. And it's interesting because what we share here, as you're understanding and working with, you know, nutraceuticals and molecules that can be synthesized by plants in some cases, you know, I have gone into the science realm with a multiple mass spec laboratory looking at plant-based molecules and looking at things and looking at contaminants and heavy metals and so on. We have six mass spec instruments in our lab now. We're about to add dioxin testing, which should be interesting. It's the first gas chromatograph interface that we've had. But the thing that I've always told people is that molecules are molecules. Mm-hmm. Let's take ivermectin. It doesn't matter if ivermectin is synthesized in a lab or if it came from a soil microbe or if it grew in a tree bark. If you isolate the molecule, that molecule, it is what it is. It doesn't have a memory of where it came from. It doesn't have an agenda. It doesn't discriminate. It has activity. It has physiological activity. It might be a polar molecule, nonpolar. It does certain things in the body, and that's it. So whether that molecule came from, you know, a pharmaceutical lab or from a tree, that's irrelevant to what it does. And we should look at all molecules with neutrality, which brings us to ivermectin. And yet, as you just said, they're not looking at molecules with, you know, an unbiased point of view.
No, if it's off patent and safe and widely available and you can get it from nature, I mean, why would they? Right. I mean, they absolutely have no incentive to do that. And, you know, that's another aspect of it. Right. It's not only, you know, the regulatory control, but it's really the education. Like, Mike, since I, you know, started my new practice and I have this deep interest, right, in studying this very complex chronic syndrome of of vaccine injury and long haul, I feel like I'm undergoing training again as a physician. Like I'm learning from so many people that are deeply studied on numerous aspects of therapeutics that are not pharma controlled, right? And so like I work with naturopaths and osteopaths and chiropractors, you know, people who do different manipulations. And then a lot of more broad-based theories like hyperbaric oxygen and ozone and things that are just really potent and safe and really can help people. And I got to tell you, it's somewhat of a joy. I feel free and I feel my mind is open and I'm filling it as fast as I can because I have a lot of patients that I'm trying to help.
Well, and this is fascinating. I want to talk about your practice in a second. But what I found over the years, just sharing this with you publicly, is that if you find a molecule of interest and you go to PubMed and you look for it, like sulforaphane, you know, synthesized in broccoli sprouts or cruciferous vegetables, for example, or curcuminoids, you know, in turmeric or what have you. You mentioned black cumin seed there. If you look at PubMed, there's actually an extraordinary amount of research on a lot of these molecules. It's just that a lot of that research is out of China, for example, or India.
So, yeah, I love that you said that. So, you know, my partner, the co-founder of our nonprofit organization, you know, Professor Paul Marek, you know, we consider Paul like the grand poobah. I mean, he's got the big brain. He researches obsessively. And what you just said, I mean, Paul has undergone just this enlightenment over the last 2 years, because it's exactly what you said. You can put in a compound or an active molecule from a plant or from any other natural source, and you can find dozens and dozens of studies showing its safety, its efficacy, how it works, what it can be applied in. But yet that doesn't enter the curriculum of a medical student.
That's right.
They teach you those options. And so it's, you know, it's good that there's a network of folks like you that, you know, putting out good sound. And I got to tell you, Mike, that's probably, I think we do similar things now. I mean, when I look at my nonprofit, we started out with the mission of just developing the most effective treatment protocols for COVID. And we did that. I would say we accomplished that. The hospital phase, we have an ever-evolving vaccine injury approach, which has a lot of the things that you just talked about, really, you know, helpful compounds. But, you know, Paul also just finished a scientific review of repurposed drugs in cancer, and not just drugs, but different therapies that really have been shown to be effective in controlling cancers. And yes. And by the way, you go to a system oncologist, what are your choices? Chemo or radiation. I mean, they do not use any other therapies. And there's actually a massive science base around a lot of really safe, widely available compounds at treating cancer. And so
I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, when they go off patent, obviously, right, they're not a financial interest to the drug companies. And yet a lot of the best molecules are from more than 17 years ago. Right. Yep. Such as ivermectin. That's a great example. And, you know, off-label prescribing has been accepted by the FDA and by the American Medical Association for a very long time until COVID. And then suddenly it was like, oh, you can't do off-label prescribing. Well, wait a second. For the last few decades, doctors have, I mean, forever, they've been using off-label prescribing where appropriate.
It's absolutely shocking, you know, and when I was still working, I mean, the last time I worked in an ICU was November of 21. So I've been out now for a year and a half. But, you know, I would go to work and when I saw what was happening around the control, especially the ivermectin being pulled from formulas, I mean, I've never in my career, Mike, been told I couldn't use an FDA approved drug.
Right.
I mean, I've never had any restrictions. And then suddenly, one of the safest drugs in history, I mean, it has literally an unparalleled safety profile. I mean, you know that they distributed across Africa and South America for, you know, the control of parasitic disease. And they've been doing decades to children and women and old people. And, you know, and suddenly it's so dangerous that they don't want you to prescribe it. I've never seen that. And just it shows you the lengths that they would go to protect that market that opened up. I mean, that's why I think you saw these unprecedented actions. I mean, they had to destroy ivermectin. Had to.
That's extraordinary. I want to encourage people to check out your book here. It's called The War on Ivermectin. It's available at Amazon and other booksellers. And it's out, June 6th? Is that what it says?
Yeah, it'll be delivered by then. Yeah.
Okay, delivered by June 6th. The medicine that saved millions and could have ended the pandemic. I completely agree. And I want to mention your practice here. The website is Dr. Pierre Corey, and that's K-O-R-Y for Corey, drpierrecorey.com. In what state is your practice, Dr. Corey?
So actually, since we do telehealth, all of us, there's a few of us in Wisconsin. That's where I live now. I'm a New Yorker. I'm from New York, but I live in Madison right now. But my colleagues are in different states, New York, Michigan. But what's interesting, Mike, you'll like this. This is kind of cool, is that we see patients in all 50 states. And one of the ways in which we are doing that is we moved our practice under the jurisdiction of what's called the First Nations Medical Board. It's actually put together by the Crow Indian tribe. And, you know, I applied, I became a registered tribal practitioner. And any patient who sees us, we just ask that they become a member of the tribe, and it's $35 a year. But I got to tell you, the patients that come to us are so happy to pay it, because by doing that as a practitioner, and let's say you're a tribal member, that relationship and my ability to care for you is completely under jurisdiction of the tribal council. And so no states have jurisdiction over, because they're coming after me from everywhere. I mean, yeah. Wisconsin has like 12 complaints against me, not by a patient, generally by physicians and pharmacists, because I'm such a depraved misinformationist, right? So I've been harassed by the state boards. But here, this is actually a federal statute which created this entity. And so it allows me to see patients in all 50 states. And we also do, you know, we do general medicine. We do a lot of health promotion and counseling. And so it's just a great group that I'm working with. And we're just kind of very happy to be protected and just kind of a little bit in a parallel system, you know, outside the system that turned on us.
See, that's extraordinary. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the current system is failing, right? The current establishment system, I mean, I think it has failed, but even in the minds of millions of Americans, it's failing, and they're looking for alternatives. That's why you said people are happy to pay that $35 a year fee. And I think that, frankly, the way that the medical establishment operated during COVID will be its downfall, because they abandoned, you know, evidence-based medicine. They abandoned medical ethics, first do no harm, the Hippocratic Oath, all of these things. And they broke the doctor-patient trust relationship, which is critical. It's the critical underpinning to medicine. If you don't trust your doctor, it's done, ultimately.
I think you've probably heard this as much as I have, but the amount of people that I meet, like when I go speak and I go to conferences, you know, people come up to me and they are terrified of going to the hospital now.
Yes.
Many of them feel... I don't know if abandoned is the right word, but they don't want to see their primary care practitioner anymore, because they were, you know, they were appropriately skeptical, asked the right questions, you know, reviewed data from numerous sources, and they came to the conclusion, which a lot of us have, that these vaccines were not only the most toxic thing we've ever unleashed, they're the most lethal and they're ineffective. So there are a large portion, I think, of, it's a minority, but there's a significant amount of Americans who found out that the vaccines were a big, big lie. And now when they go to their doctors, and they go to see doctors who have believed that lie, and this is my knock on the system, doctors, Mike, is that, and I think it could have happened to me, it didn't, but I think that the doctors, first of all, didn't ask enough questions, were not skeptical enough. They placed, basically, the problem is they placed way too much faith in the institutions of medicine,
right,
in the agencies, in Fauci and journals, and they were lied to. And so whether they were unknowingly lied to, or they kind of just didn't want to fight back against the lies, I will tell you there's a large portion of US society who they are fleeing. They do not want to go, like they're terrified of going to the hospital and having people around them who have been, I guess the word would be, brainwashed with propaganda and censorship.
Well, I completely agree. I think you're accurate in describing that. I want to share with you my personal experience with ivermectin and get your feedback on it. And you'll recognize this. It's a 1 milliliter pipette. And even long before COVID, I had purchased ivermectin agricultural use because I have monkeys and goats and chickens and dogs, by the way. And I was using a pipette like this and doing the dosage, you know, based on the kilograms of body weight of the dogs to dose out ivermectin as a heartworm preventative treatment for my dogs. Yep. So, you know, I can't say that everybody has pipettes. I mean, but they're not that expensive, you know, $50 on Amazon or whatever, and you dial in the numbers. It's not that difficult. But then when COVID hit and I began to learn about ivermectin, I started dosing myself with the same thing, right? Which I never would have thought to do that before. I had no intention to take ivermectin myself. And yet now today, and even though ivermectin is synthesized now in pharmaceutical companies, I consider it an essential part of my first aid kit. And frankly, and you probably heard this before, and I can't recommend this to anybody else. I'm not your doctor, but I take about, what do I do? I do about 1.6 milliliters of this, of a 1% solution before I ever go speak publicly or interact with a crowd. I take it prophylactically. That's just me.
Yes. So, you know, although in the book, I really go over how they attack the massive evidence base for ivermectin in treatment, what's interesting is I do address in the book, what they did to the evidence in prevention. Because actually the evidence as a preventative of COVID is incredible. It's like eye-popping. I mean, there's literally 18 studies. Think about five of them are randomized controlled trials. Other ones are of similarly high quality but different designs, and they show these massive reductions in your risk of getting COVID with really tight statistical significance. Like, I've never seen a collection of trials with tight, massive, statistically significant benefits. And so, you know, we have a prevention protocol. I would say a lot of people followed, especially when the variants were more deadly, right, and more severe. Like late phase Delta was wicked. But yes, so my patients, especially those with long haul and vaccine injury, most of them are on ivermectin either as a treatment or as a preventative, because when they get COVID, a lot of times they'll relapse. Their symptoms of their chronic illness gets worse because each spike protein exposure. But I also have patients who are, you know, some are more cautious or risk tolerant than others. And that's one of the approaches that I outline, which is exactly what you do. I say, now you could take it chronically, you know, twice a week, or you could just use it for periods where you're having a lot of travel and exposure, you know, or you could just take it upon first symptoms of a viral syndrome. And so there's a few ways of doing that. And now that the variants are milder, I think the right size approach is what you're doing for sure.
Well, and I'll tell you, my own family member started to become symptomatic, tested positive for COVID using one of the at-home tests. We got her on ivermectin, and she was symptom free within 5 days.
Yep. Yeah. What I'll say about ivermectin is that up until Delta, it was a COVID slayer. I mean, I would put people on ivermectin and over and over and over again, no matter what day they were sick, like day one, day three, day five, within 12 to 24 hours, they would tell me the next day, like, my God, by the evening, this felt better, or that felt better. My feet broke, my heart rate went down, I got a little more energy today. And so I would see these robust responses. When Delta came around, those robust responses became less because it had a lot higher viral load. It was also a little bit deadlier, just had a higher viral load. And then late phase Delta, there was a period there where ivermectin alone wasn't enough for people. I mean, I was even using higher doses, but we had been using combination protocols since the beginning, you know, and Nigella sativa is on there, curcumin is on there, honey is on there. I mean, those are actually pretty potent antivirals and anti-inflammatory. And so we always use a combination, but you're right. Ivermectin, I mean, people generally, and most importantly, it's not even how fast it takes them to feel better, is they don't go to the hospital. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, you don't die. And I mean, you know, I've had people that had a rough go of COVID, even when I treated them with, you know, multiple medicines, but none of them went to the hospital and none of them died.
Well, and now in retrospect, we know that a lot of the so-called COVID deaths were actually ventilator deaths or infections that were worsened by ventilator treatments.
We
and so it's quite rational for people to fear going to the hospital and then being diagnosed with COVID and then being put on these very invasive, sometimes deadly protocols. And we've also interviewed attorneys here that talked about how hospitals were financially incentivized to diagnose with COVID and then even achieve a fatality, they get more money. I mean, gosh, that's
where you see the causes of death being monkeyed around with. You know, I mean, if they weren't overtly, it's hard for me on the ventilator thing. For me, the ventilator, although there are financial incentives, in my experience in running ICUs, the early intubation practices, I didn't see that as a corrupt exercise. I saw that as an ignorant and fearful one.
I see.
Because I saw how the doctors were behaving. It was a new disease. They were afraid. And many of them just don't have experience managing acute respiratory failure, which I am an expert in. And I'll tell you a little anecdote about that. So I was the chief of the critical care service, and I was the director of the main medical surgical ICU at the University of Wisconsin when COVID hit. And, you know, when COVID was coming, because we were in Wisconsin, we saw it, you know, we saw Italy getting hit, New York and Seattle and New Orleans. In Wisconsin, we had a little bit of delay. So we had a lot of preparation. We were holding meetings every day. And I was leading those meetings. And all of the ICU guys were on there, the residents, the students, the hospitalists. And, you know, we had new policies and approaches every day. And one day, a couple of anesthesiology colleagues who did critical care, they came up to me and they started saying, Pierre, we need to have a trigger to intubate someone. And they proposed anyone on 6 liters of oxygen or more should be intubated. Whoa. And I looked at them and my mouth dropped. And I was like, are you guys crazy? I've never heard of an oxygen intake as a trigger for intubation. We don't use oxygen levels to decide to intubate someone. What you do is you use what's called the work of breathing. You have to look at the patient. Is their work of breathing so elevated that they will not be able to sustain that and they're going to crash? Because you do want to put someone on a ventilator before they crash. So the trick to initiating mechanical ventilation is don't do it too early and don't do it too late. But there's an art to that and you need experience. And I saw that, you know, and those colleagues that came up to me that told me to do that, you know, I think they prefaced it with saying, you know, we have friends who are at this university or that university and they have these triggers. And I spoke really forcefully at that meeting that day. And I told everyone who was on that line that were listening from their homes or from their offices, I said, we will not be doing that. I said, you guys have to stick with the time-honored approach. You have to, you know, assess the work of breathing. And we cannot be putting patients on ventilators early because ventilators are double-edged swords. They bring risks and benefits. And the best way to use them is like I described. And I will tell you that there was not a lot of blowback from what I said, and we never instituted a trigger at the University of Wisconsin, but that's not the case with a lot of hospitals. But I could see it's because the doctors were scared, there was a lot of patients, and I think everybody craves simplicity, right, and protocols. And and I think, you know, that was some of what was behind that.
There's also a tendency in medicine to do something rather than nothing.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Even if the something might carry additional risk, it's you don't want to be the doctor that is blamed. Oh, you stood by and you did nothing.
Agreed. You're absolutely right about that. You nailed that on the head. I mean, it's, you know, it's the psychology and experience of being a doctor. And sometimes I see doctors, I don't think that they're sizing up situations or making good judgments. And sometimes it's implicit fears, explicit fears, and, or really just ignorance of the disease and how best to manage it. And you needed a lot of experts. The problem was there was way more patients than there were guys like me, you know, that had been managing acute respiratory failure for decades.
All right, now let's talk about the aftermath of this and your clinic right now. Leading Edge Clinic, again, drpierrecorey.com is the website for that. I'd like to ask you, Dr. Corey, about what's sometimes called long COVID or just ongoing symptoms because of what I believe is spike protein toxicity and other factors, but I'm talking about neurological symptoms that persist in a lot of people, not just respiratory or cardiovascular, but neurological symptoms. I personally know people who are very messed up. One is a nurse, just took one vaccine and her life was destroyed and she didn't take another shot and she's still trying to recover, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars later. What does your clinic do to help people heal?
It's so sad, this disease, right? So So me and my partner, I mean, we have more people now that are doing general medicine, but it's really just the two of us. Me and my partner focus on what we call post-vaccination injury syndrome and or long-haul COVID syndromes. And so really that syndrome, and the way I define and diagnose is that it's a constellation of symptoms that develop in temporal association to one of those events. So for many, they got COVID, they got better, and then suddenly they start getting these this weird constellation of symptoms. And then for others, it really starts with the vaccine, either the day of or within most of them, it's really within days to a week or two that their symptoms start. But, you know, the constellation of symptoms, I describe it as this. There are three core symptoms that they suffer. When I say core or cardinal, almost every patient I see with the syndrome has these three. Number one is fatigue, and sometimes just severe, unrelenting, unprecedented fatigue. Closely associated with that is post-exertional malaise, which is when they try to exert themselves or do activity, it either worsens their fatigue or their other symptoms. And then the third, and we'll get to what you brought up, is what we call brain fog, which is we see some deficit in cognition. So it's either short-term memory. I've even had patients with long-term memory problems, processing of tasks or ability to concentrate or focus. And these patients just, they don't feel right and their brains aren't working right. And that's just the brain fog, right? So almost everyone has all three. On occasion, I'll see someone who just has the fatigue or post-exertion malaise. But once you get past those three, now you're dealing with any dozens of symptoms that I see. And the neurologic ones are probably the most prevalent. So I see lots of neuropathies, so burning, pins and needles, tingling, electric shock-like feelings, numbness. So I see sensory problems on the sensory nerves. I see motor problems. So I see uncontrolled contractions of muscles called fasciculations. I've had patients with tremors, with convulsions. Then when you think of the skull or cranium, you know, so much people with tinnitus, you know, the ringing in the ears, vertigo, headaches. I've had patients with vision problems. And then obviously, as you know, the nose and taste. I've even had people with hearing loss. And so the neurologic devastation of these jabs is really almost indescribable. And you know, the thing that like makes me sad to hear about your nurse friend is that one of the remarkable things about the patients in my practice is how many of them are, you know, of working age. They're either in their 30s, 40s, or 50s. But when I take their history, the first time I see them, they describe to me like these pictures of health. So happily married with kids, a career, love to exercise, cycled 100 miles a week or ran 30 miles a week, ate organic, you know, like they like took meticulous care of themselves. And now so many of them are like effectively they meet the criteria for disability. In fact, if not, most of them are. They can't work. They can't exert themselves. And so, you know, that's a description of the syndrome that I'm facing. And then what we do for them is over the last year and a half, we just are constantly evolving and finding new strategies of things that work, you know, the mainstays. So basically, since we don't really have good clinical evidence, we have a lot of clinical experience, but we kind of choose therapies based on the pharmacologic mechanisms of action or the whatever the therapeutic mechanism of action is, that matches the different pathophysiologies that we've identified that are triggered by the spike. You know, the autoimmunity, the persistent macrophage activation, the microclotting, nitric oxide pathway dysfunction, mitochondrial dysfunction, immune dysregulation with reactivation of viruses. I mean, it's a really complex disease. And I will say we do trials of therapy. And like I have first line, second line, third line, because you can't put someone on 10 things at once. Not everyone needs 10 things. But my first line, Mike, wait for it. Ivermectin and low dose naltrexone. Actually, I also use natokinase and melatonin as I have a couple other things that I use, but kind of the more potent therapies that I use as first line is ivermectin and low dose naltrexone. And those are both very safe. They have numerous mechanisms. Anti-inflammatory, immunomodulatory, and the other reason why I use them is not just because they make sense on paper, but they have the highest response rate in my practice. I would say 70% of my patients will have a positive clinical response to ivermectin. It may even be a little higher, but I'll tell you the flip side of that. The ivermectin non-responders, I know that road is going to be longer and harder. For some reason, the ones that get response to ivermectin, they seem to respond to a number of other things that I do as well. And when they don't respond to ivermectin, it's almost like a marker that it's going to be harder to treat them. And then, yeah, and I'm sure you're aware of the properties of that, you know, low dose naltrexone. That seems to do a lot, especially for the neurologic problems, the neuropathies. Has been very helpful with, but yeah, I do bunches of other stuff, you know, as second line and third line, and quite a few of them are nutraceuticals as well.
See, that's what's extraordinary, because you're dealing with obviously an onset of some kind of damage has taken place. The body needs to be given an opportunity to self-repair, but there are limits to that, especially neurologically, as you well know. But then there's also persistent continued exposure in some people's cases, correct? Because of the mRNA aspects of this. What are you observing in that area? I mean, yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask a question. I mean, this exposure, right? So it comes in a couple of forms, right? And it's not only being around people who are sick, but unfortunately we do see enough evidence now that shedding events happen. I have more questions around shedding than I do answers.
Yeah, me too.
I do not believe, but that's clearly a phenomenon. So we've had too many patients that have had exposures to people generally recently vaccinated, but now we're finding examples where some of the shedders are not recently vaccinated. But we've had people who their symptoms flared and they got sick after just being around someone who was vaccinated. Yes. And so, but in general, with any exposure, whether it's natural infection, you know, or near an ill person, or it's the spike from, you know, a vaccinated patient or a person, I generally see the symptoms flare and relapse. And I've had a couple of really tough cases where I had one patient who was really, really sick, and we put her back together. She was doing so well. She regained so much function, so much reduction in her symptom severity. And then she got COVID and she relapsed almost to worse to when I first treated her. And I'm having a dickens of a time trying to get her well again. And it's, I mean, this spike protein it's so toxic. It's really nasty. And I don't know why some people are more sensitive to, I mean, I have seen patterns. I have seen some illnesses that that seem to suggest a susceptibility to it. But it's wicked for those that have been made ill from this on a chronic basis.
Well, and I don't know how much you cover this or even speak about it, but, you know, the other experts I've interviewed say it's the perfect weapon because it was, you know, engineered to be a weapon, right?
And when you think about that and you think of some of the sequences genetically they put in there and you see the amount of autoantibodies that thing generates, right? So it basically, you get exposed, we make antibodies to different proteins on that surface. And those, a lot of those antibodies cross-react with really important tissues in the body.
Yes.
So autoimmunity has, like, so if you were some, you know, malevolent, you know, evil lab person, and we're trying to design something that would provoke and stimulate disease in the human, I think there's a really good argument to say that that's quite possible. What their motives were, why they would do such a thing, I don't know, but certainly I think that's a credible argument. Oh, you know, I wanted to mention one other thing, Mike. I think we have a mutual friend. I'm really good friends with Peter Simonson of Juvent. You know, the device.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You have one, I think, right?
Yes, I use it every day.
So I want to bring that up because I started learning about the mechanisms around the Juvent and you know how it works, and then I started, you know, reading a little bit and I talked to Peter, and I got to tell you, in the patients in my practice who've used the Juvent, holy cow, I have seen like dramatic, in fact, Peter has gotten written testimonials from my patients who found these just fantastic benefits from, and some of it has been pre-morbid stuff like knee pains and joint problems and back pains that they've seen resolve with using that. And so I bring that up only because I think I know you have the device, And that's one of the things that I'll use. And it's not for everybody. Not everyone wants to, you know, spend the money, even though you get refunded. But I got to tell you that those that I've put on, I've had really consistent positive responses.
Well, that's extraordinary. I brought up the webpage here of the Juvent webpage so people know what we're talking about. It's a platform. It's a micro impact platform. And I literally use it every day. And let me tell you, anybody who suffers from constipation probably can have most people can have your problem solved. Step on that plate for 5 minutes and it's a done deal. But yeah, which is extraordinary. It tells you that it's having physiological effects that are far more than just whatever bones and joints, right?
Yeah, we've seen that. I mean, mostly I hear the bone and joint symptoms improve. But I've had, my patients have so many symptoms, but I've had other things improve. My wife is a former scholarship tennis player at University of Michigan. And I mean, she played tennis at very high levels when she was younger. And, you know, as any other ex-athlete at that level, I mean, she has terrible knee problems. But she started using it, and now she's able to play on a tennis league. I mean, she still has, you know, aches and pains and soreness. I mean, she has pretty bad knees, but just the fact that she can get out on the court without too much suffering is huge for her. She loves tennis.
But you were saying, I mean, that's extraordinary, by the way, and I'm really glad that she can resume activity with the help of that. But you were saying, I thought you said that even, you know, your COVID sufferers are having beneficial effects.
Yes.
To what do you ascribe that?
So some of them do, you know, well, so the way in which I think of the Juvent, right? So bone, right? So the strength of bone really responds to different nutrients as well as a mechanical load being placed on it, right? That's why we have to be active and walk. And that makes the strength of the bone. But the other thing that's in bone is the bone marrow, which is literally the source of who we are and what we are, right? All of our blood cells, immune cells, all of our tissues come out of stem cells in the bone marrow. And that device can also stimulate the function of bone. At least that's how I think of it. And so when you look at a syndrome which has a dysregulated immune system, right, which is this post-COVID and post-vaccine syndromes, you know, you do wonder whether it's the stimulation of the bone marrow and the immune cells that has some positive beneficial effect at mitigating some of these other symptoms. Because you're right, it's not always just the, you know, the bone and joint pains that improve. And I think one of my patients even talked about brain fog improving on it. And I know that Peter's had different patients that have had energy return. And so how it works in the individual patient, I'm not always sure of, but it certainly seemed to have been a benefit. Like literally, I remember I saw a patient about a month ago. I told Peter this. I get on the visit, we start chatting, and she goes to me, she goes, "That Juvent, I will sell that for you." And I was like, "I don't make money off the Juvent." I said, "I'm just glad you like it." She just went on and on about how much she liked it. And then she ended up writing a letter to Juvent just thanking them. And anyway, this sounds like a Juvent commercial, but I just liked the device. And I knew that you had a connection and had also liked the device. And I found it helpful.
Well, thank you for bringing it up. And the reason I hadn't mentioned it for so long is because Pete told me they couldn't even catch up on orders until recently. I think just in the last couple of weeks, he said they've got their production back up. But I have another question for you, and this is a genuine question, and I'm wondering about, have you looked into the chemical constituents of lion's mane mushroom? And the reason I ask is because I'm currently growing lion's mane, and it's easy to grow. It's a beautiful little fungi. And I accidentally injured myself a few weeks ago, somewhat severely, and I'm having to regrow some nerves and some blood supply and whatever. And so I'm actually using lion's mane right now as a, well, you know, it can't hurt type of thing in my smoothies. You know, here's my smoothie for today. It's got lion's mane in it. So I like to grow my own stuff as much as possible because then I can control the quality. But have you by chance looked into lion's mane as a neurological?
Yes. Yeah, so two things about that. So the best answer is, Mike, I literally have a list of about 40 different therapeutics that are like on my list of things to do deep dives on.
Yeah.
The list is dizzying. But here's the thing about lion's mane is that I have heard really positive things. One of my closest colleagues, a guy who I made friends and became collegial with in COVID, he's this brilliant, like, savant guy. I mean, he knows the history of medicine. He actually is deeply studied on all disciplines in medicine, like, you know, osteopathy, homeopathy, naturopathy, and he's just this brilliant guy. His email is actually lion'smanemushrooms@somethingelse.com. And so, like, he loves lion's mane.
Really?
And I believe my mother is on it. I think it's lion's mane. My mother has melanoma, and I had her see an integrative oncologist who has her on a pretty broad repurposed drug and nutraceutical regimen. And I believe one of them, I know there's one mushroom on her list, and I think it's lion's mane, but I may be wrong about that.
Okay.
But it's on my list of things to learn more about it.
Well, I know you and I, we have very long lists, and I don't know the conclusions, but I know it's reputed to be involved in nerve repair. Although, you know, in mammalian species, nerve repair, there's a limit to how much you can do, right? You know, we're not iguanas, can't just regrow entire limbs that I know of, unless somebody's had a breakthrough somewhere.
Right. You know, and that's some of that, you know, I use near infrared light is thought to be able to stimulate some nerve regeneration. So I use a lot of near infrared light. I use methylene blue. The latest thing that me and my partner have started after deep study is we're actually using the combination of stem cell derived exosome therapy.
Oh, really?
With stem cells. And the exosomes in particular, exosomes are these tiny nanoparticle-sized sacs with a fatty membrane that are released by stem cells. And they kind of have this paracrine function. They affect the function of cells nearby. So they're really kind of messenger nanoparticles. They generally promote anti-inflammation, healing, tissue regeneration, because they have growth factors in there. It's a little bit magical how it works because it's still under deep study, but we've seen also some really positive benefits with those therapies, especially around nerves. In fact, there was a case report of an animal report of, like, I think a spinal cord transection, which healed with exosomes and stem cells. And so that's another, when you talk about the nerve regeneration, but a lot of the stuff that we do also is we're focusing on what we call neuroinflammation. Like, that brain fog has a number of mechanisms, but it's neuroinflammation. And then the other thing, Mike, is that what's the problem with these patients is when they go to system doctors, they'll get a battery of tests, right? Lab tests, blood tests, and sometimes imaging because they have so many cranial symptoms. They'll get CTs and MRIs, even EEGs. Guess what, Mike? All of it is normal or really non-actionable. And so the inflammation lies below the threshold of detection for imaging. And really, I'm always shocked at how sick the patients are and how normal their blood profiles look using standard testing.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I actually think this is probably a bigger topic, but my belief is that there's a number of diseases out there that have as their underlying cause brain inflammation. And I will tell you, the field of neurology, they are not taught about brain inflammation. They're taught about the diseases called encephalitis and meningitis, but they don't understand that the brain can be inflamed and look totally normal. And I would say a lot of the neurologists that my patients have seen, they don't know how to help these patients.
Hmm. Well, I'll just share this and then we'll wrap this up. I appreciate your time, but you know, my background being in food toxicology, I've had people who have this neurological inflammation, you know, post-vaccine or post-COVID, ask me, you know, what can they do to bring that down? And I've said, look, it can't hurt to get all of the so-called excitotoxins out of your diet. You know, the MSG, the yeast extract, these things that are neurological inflammatory molecules, you know, to have taste, excitatory taste function. Get those out of your diet. Just clean up your diet at least. And of course, do other things like visit you, Dr. Corey, but I find that a lot of people are really hurting themselves through the toxic food intake that is ongoing. It's chronic.
No question. I would love if everyone saw you first before, or talked to you first before they came to me, because you're right. I mean, the dietary interventions, first of all, I mean, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's a simple thing that anyone can do, right? And you will see, it's sometimes shocking to see how much of their symptoms are actually reduced by changing just the diet, right? And so, you know, instead of throwing medicines and supplements and nutraceuticals, I mean, you want to start with the basics, but which is right. Don't, you know, create a vicious cycle. Don't do anything that's going to make these things worse. And you'll find like these, either I have them do like kind of an elimination diet approach, or a lot of my patients have tried different things on their own. And then they share with me what they found that worked, but certainly getting rid of the processed foods, the MSG and all those things, would be, you know, the easiest start.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's yeast extract and MSG and almost everything these days. You open up someone's pantry, you know, all the sauces, all the gravy mixes, all the chips, it all has MSG in it, and they're dealing with neurological inflammation at the same time, or migraines or something. And, you know, sometimes they can be helped easily, or at least can help reduce some of the symptoms. But look, you and I could probably spend hours talking about all these things. I just want to say I really honor what you're doing and the people that you are helping. And I wish that our medical system would listen more intently to people like yourself, Dr. Corey, because, you know, you have compassion and knowledge, and that's what medicine is supposed to be.
Yeah. You know, Mike, I'll just say the last thing, like everything that I've done and am doing in since COVID started is what I've always done. Like, I haven't become a different doctor. I mean, I've loved medicine and I love becoming a doctor. And really what I was an educator. I mean, I ran training programs and taught students and residents. You know, I was the guy like House, you know, when I ran rounded in the ICU, I have like 10 people follow me around, and I love teaching. And I thought that what I and my close colleagues did in COVID, I didn't think we'd be so alone. I didn't think we'd be such a small minority of folks who like stood up and said, this is the right thing to do for this. Let's follow this approach. This makes sense. And instead we were a small number and we got, you know, viciously attacked. And that was the surprise to me. I thought a lot of docs were like me and would have wanted to go out there and just argue for something logical and pragmatic and, you know, that worked on a risk-benefit analysis. I mean, you realize we went through a year where the government and the agencies are telling us there is no treatment. Go home.
Yeah,
until I mean, there's no disease that can't be treated. There is no disease that can't be treated. I mean, you can at least, with your developing knowledge, come up with some therapies that would be work or be helpful, like you said, in prevention. And so I was astonished at how few doctors were making that argument, you know, like, you know, they accepted this preposterous idea that you can't treat. And just like they accepted this preposterous idea that natural immunity had no protection, right? You know, and by the way, Mike, that's a whole other thing we talk about. That one was really shocking to me when natural immunity disappeared overnight just because of some words on the FDA website. Literally, they just put a couple of paragraphs which told doctors, don't check antibodies before vaccine, and whether they have natural immunity or not, you need to vaccinate. As soon as I saw that, I remember just being like, what are they doing? Yeah. How can they do this? And so, anyway, I just thought there'd be more doctors who would have had the same reactions and come out and fought back against this absurdity and inanity.
Well, we should have. A lot of lives could have been saved, but at least people like yourself are speaking out right now and authoring books. And just remind the audience here, the book is called The War on Ivermectin. You can get it at booksellers everywhere. It's available here shortly, early June. And Dr. Corey, I just want to thank you for all that you're doing and for spending time with us. This has been a really fascinating conversation. I think people will get a lot of value from this.
I love talking to you. I like you said, I think we could probably go another couple hours. So
yeah.
I'm back anytime you want to chat, Mike.
A lot of knowledge base here, but thank you. And I know you have a lot of patients to help, so we'll let you get back. But we appreciate you. Thank you for joining me today.
Till next time.
Okay, take care. And for those of you watching, I hope you enjoyed this interview. Fascinating, truly. And feel free to share it everywhere. You can repost this as well. You have our permission. And just give credit to Dr. Pierre Corey and his website. Dr. Pierre Corey, it's not showing up here. DrPierreCorey.com is the website. And he's also with the FLCCC Alliance. So thank you for joining me today. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com, the free speech video platform where you can hear the truth like you just heard here today. Thank you for joining me. Take care. Today's interview is brought to you by healthrangerstore.com, where we have a full selection of superfoods, nutrients, and herbs, by the way. I've got it up on my screen here. Just some of the herbs that we typically carry, like echinacea and cayenne and oil of oregano, and so much more. You can search our website for organic turmeric and so on. Lots of herbs that we offer, all laboratory tested for heavy metals, glyphosate, and so much more. Plus, we have superfoods, personal care products, and synthetic chemical-free products for your home, your body, personal care, mouthwash, deodorant, toothpaste, you name it. All custom formulated just for us, and often by myself, but not every single formula. But I have a hand in a lot of them. I approve all of them because I'm very meticulous about the ingredients that I allow in my own body or on my skin or in my home. And so if you agree with my philosophy on that, you want clean food and highly potent nutrients and herbs and superfoods, then you'll really support what we're doing at healthrangerstore.com. So check it all out, healthrangerstore.com. We've got sales from time to time. Buy something, get on our email list. You'll be alerted to various specials. And we appreciate your support. Thank you for supporting us. We couldn't do this without you. I'm Mike Adams, founder of Brighteon and founder of healthrangerstore.com. Take care. A global reset is coming. And that's why I've recorded a new 9-hour audiobook. It's called The Global Reset Survival Guide. You can download it for free by subscribing to the naturalnews.com email newsletter, which is also free. I'll describe how the monetary system fails. I also cover emergency medicine and first aid and what to buy to help you avoid infections. So download this guide. It's free. It's my gift to you simply because I want like-minded people to survive.